Good morning and welcome. It's Saturday, it's 10 a.m. It means it's time for Final Draft, books writing, literary culture, right here on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel. Every week I bring you books, I bring you writing, and just really, we're trying to find your next favourite read. Now, I'm taking a little bit of a break at the moment to catch up on my reading pile, the ever-growing reading pile, but I'm not going to leave you without the books. Today on the show, I'm going to revisit a conversation that I had originally for 2SER's Gay Panic program. If you want to catch more of Gay Panic, every Friday evening, but you can also go to 2SER.com. Stick around right now, though. I'm going to be speaking with Nevo Zizan about their memoir, Finding Nevo. It details Nevo's gender transition and also an exploration of the broader changes that are happening in our society that are slowly meaning more visibility and acceptance of transgender Australians. It's a really great conversation. I enjoyed speaking with Nevo. You might have caught Nevo on shows like Hacks, really sort of very interesting exploration of masculine culture and privilege. We go into that conversation today, also on Channel 7. But this is a really in-depth conversation that I'm excited to bring you. So don't go anywhere. You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. And after a short break, I'm going to be back with some books.
What have you always wondered about Sydney and the people who call it home? 2SER is Seeking Sydney. Head over to 2SER.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate. While you're there, why not vote for whichever question you'd like answered? 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, where you're listening to Final Draft. Today on the show, we're revisiting a conversation that was originally recorded for 2SER's Gay Panic program. I'm speaking with Nevo Zizan about their memoir, Finding Nevo. And welcome to 2SER. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Look, I rarely get to speak to authors in studio, and I really love the opportunity because it's a great way to get to know a book. But look, it's not really, this is your memoir, and it's not really my place to try and sum up your life in a few pithy sentences. But I'm interested, what do you want readers to know and understand approaching Finding Nevo?
I guess, well, firstly, it is a memoir about gender transition and sexuality. However, I think it's also just much more broadly than that, a memoir about the human condition in a way that everyone can relate to. I mean, I talk about body image and family and growing up and going to school and the sort of difficulties that one encounters. So what I want people to know is it's an important read in understanding gender and understanding gender transition, but it's also important for anyone who has never navigated those topics before. I want them to be able to find themselves in the story regardless of gender transition.
Yeah. Now, you're 21. You haven't had any birthdays since writing the book?
No.
No, 21. Great. You're 21 and you begin your story noting the irony of telling a life at 21, and you close reflecting on the difficulty of stopping a story. That's for you, it's continuing every day. And you're right, this isn't something most 21-year-olds find themselves doing. What moved you to put pen to paper?
I just wasn't seeing myself being represented in the ways that I needed. And as a kid, particularly when I first discovered that I was transgender, I needed a role model and I needed a future. I didn't know what my future could be. So I suppose I wanted to pay homage to the elders past and present who have, you know, sort of paved the road for me to be able to write this and to actually use those privileges and platforms to write something for future generations so they have some sort of, not guidebook, but like support, you know, because it feels really lonely out there a lot.
So at the beginning of chapter two, you know that the following parts may seem disjointed. People think about writing a story, you know, a story starts, it's got middle and it has an end. And that's what a life feels like too a lot of the time. Mm. But your introduction, you're quite scattershot of details that you want people to know before settling into a more linear telling. But how did you go about structuring and editing vignettes that would resonate both for you and for your readers? Did you have a sense of readership in mind?
I did, yeah. I mean, I would sort of go between the people who really know about this topic and, you know, sort of queer people my age and then young people and then the people who have no idea about any of it. So it's quite a broad demographic and I wanted to be accessible to all of those people at once. And I did have issues because I'm an academic, and that's the kind of language that I use a lot. I did have issues with sort of over-intellectualizing my language and not getting to the sort of emotional grit of it. And my editor would have to just be like, look, this is great, really interesting, but what were you feeling? What were you going through? And that was scarier for me, obviously. You know, like, I can do the, like, fluffy words, but what I was actually going through, I had to relive that in order to write that. So the way I actually structured the book upon first draft was in little paragraphs that were disjointed with little topics. So, like, you know, year 11 or coming out or whatever, they were smaller paragraphs. And we were initially going to have it as sort of a list kind of book. And then that changed and evolved through editing and through time. But yeah, that chapter two is still kind of left in that version, because I guess as much as our lives are linear, they're also really not. You know, like, we go around in circles and we go around the bend, and every time we go around we're a little bit stronger, but we repeat patterns all the time. And I wanted to sort of show snapshots into different parts of my life that weren't necessarily so linear, but rather thematic.
So you've included a glossary, which I guess to an extent does help the reader approach any more academic terms, as you've mentioned. But were there any, you said, you know, a part of that your editor challenged you to go into your experience? What were you feeling? Was there anything that was too raw to make the page? And I guess I'm asking you something that if it was, you might not be able to answer.
Look, it was all pretty raw. There's none of it that was just super easy to write. A lot of it I had to just put my head down and just get out on paper and cry a lot. And, you know, I really needed to be authentic to all these different incarnations of myself. So in order to do that, I actually had to go back and be them again. And that was really confronting. So I didn't just write, I researched myself in that time and really tried to put myself back into that person and get those thoughts back and actually ask myself how I was feeling. Because when I was writing from the perspective of Navor, the 19, 20, 21-year-old, it was too retrospective, and it was too like, this is what I was doing, but actually I should have been, you know, and I had to just be like, that's not even true. Like, you're actually lying about that person. You need to be that person again. So it was really cathartic to do that, but it was also really painful and re-traumatizing. And I often say, you know, it's very hard to tell stories that you'd rather forget. So most of it, if not all of it, made it on the page. And a lot of the things that I didn't want to include eventually came out anyway, because they were important for the story.
So notions of community are reflected heavily throughout the story. The support that you find in the LGBTQIA plus community, your Jewish community, but then also the ways in which, say, aspects of life at school and beyond left you feeling without or outside of a supportive community. Can you reflect for me just a little bit, though, on what role a community plays in a personal journey such as yours?
Yeah, I think community plays every role. I think, like, you know, I think that we live in a society that really profits off our individualism and just being our own efficient kind of product. And it doesn't work well for the system when you band together and show each other a lot of love. And, you know, like, you're supposed to just have your head down and be there for yourself. So I could not have survived without community, for sure. And there are many people who haven't. And I think that it's a really natural inclination to want to belong and to feel loved and supported. So, you know, throughout my life, that has always been a consistent need and desire of mine. And it's my focus, is creating community, being there for community, whether it's queer or Jewish or whatever. I think every kid really needs to feel supported and not be in systems that, you know, pin them against each other. And we're all experiencing, like, our experiences in life are so similar one from the other. And yeah, they're different, but we can all relate on various levels and various axes. And I think that that's really crucial.
Yeah, at the stage where you're in the memoir, where you're graduating high school, and you reflect about the support or lack of support that you're getting, and particularly it was kind of like the muck-up day end of school performance dance. And at one point you reflect that, you know, like, you will be beyond this, and there will be people that if you choose not to, you won't have to see. Mm-hmm. Do you ever sort of think, I want to go back, I want to actually help establish community there, maybe help people know you better in a way that they didn't at the time?
Do you mean go back now or go back in time?
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, do you ever, are there some communities that you just think, well, okay, you were never going to have me, and stuff you off you go, or do you really hope that communities can ultimately be embracing?
Right. It's funny because I was thinking, if you mean go back in time, no. There's no way I'm going back to high school. Don't make me, please. No, but in as far as that goes, yeah, totally. Like, I have been back to my school. I've done speeches. I'm actually speaking at a teachers' conference to make safer spaces in classrooms with them. I've gone to lots of different schools and universities and workplaces. I have faith in every organization. Like, I think that every aspect of the world can change. And that is included in a religious school. I think if you're open and loving and honest and willing to evolve, anything can happen. And that's always my main message, is that we're all just people. We're all oppressed by gender roles to a certain extent. How far that extent goes is different for everyone. But I just want a world where people can wake up and be whoever they want to be and don't have all of these subscribed and prescribed expectations of them every second that are just debilitating. So if that's going to help kids in schools, which I really believe it will, then yeah, I'm in, and I will take any opportunity. I mean, I've been in plenty of positions with a much more conservative audience, or, you know, a group that wouldn't normally be my demographic, and I am all in. Like, I want to be there and I want to try.
You are on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and the voice you have been hearing is Nevor Zizan discussing their memoir, Finding Nevor. We're going to take a track now before we come back with the second half of that conversation. This is sort of new from Beach House. It's called Baby, and it's from a new album called B-Sides and Rarities. This is 2SER 107.3. That track there was from Beach House. It's called Baby. Now, you are listening to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and we're now going to go back to the second half of my conversation with Nevor Zizan. This conversation was originally recorded for Gay Panic, which you can catch every Friday evening on 2SER. And we are discussing Nevor's book, Finding Nevor. Throughout Finding Never, you reflect on your struggle to understand and have a healthy relationship with your body. Much of this is conditioned by the roles and preconceptions that society brings to bear daily on all of us. So with the benefit of distance, do you see any evolution for better or maybe even for worse in these conceptions of gender and sexuality?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's interesting because I think that we're coexisting at the moment with an apocalyptic kind of political landscape while also a revolution. And I think these things are actually going to meet at an intersection at one point and battle it out, and one will win. And I think it's going to be the right side that wins. I'm seeing a change
all
the time.
Would it be fair to say the right side is the left side here?
Just yes. For sure. Yeah, don't get that wrong. Yeah, I think that we really are sitting on the cusp of a queer and trans revolution. I say it all the time. I can see things changing. I mean, within the queer community, our politics are shifting and changing all the time. The debates that we're having, it's just mind-boggling and fascinating. But outside of that bubble, there's so much changing as well. I mean, when I came out in 2013, there was nothing about transgender in the mainstream whatsoever. And then Time Out named 2014 as the transgender tipping point. And since then, we have just seen such a variety of diversity and representation and, yeah, problematic in a lot of ways. But I think going on Channel 7 yesterday really showed me that the world can change because it's such a mainstream program, and they were so open to me, you know, contributing to the script and talking about the language that I wanted used, and that gave me so much hope. And I just felt like now more than ever we have hope for the future.
And so you were given the advice to stop trying to be a man by, I think it's probably the first trans man mm-hmm. that you really got to know through the story. And he was basically telling you that you were already your own man, and that was special. You didn't need to perform some version of masculinity. But this is a message that's blasted at us across all aspects of our life. You know, you walk down the road, billboards. Don't go outside, that's okay. Insta posts are going to reinforce a particular, mm-hmm. fairly inflexible way of being. How much do we actually suffer, do you think, under these notions of there's a performative way of being, there's a way you have to be?
To a debilitating extent. I think that we really underestimate how much it indoctrinates us on a really implicit and covert level that we can't even really pick up on. And it's funny because I see it mostly from the people who are violently transphobic. I just look at them and I think, oh my gosh, you are the ones that are the most oppressed by this, because they see you who is performing masculinity or embracing masculinity in a totally different way, and they're just like, hey, I've spent my whole life conforming to these standards, like everyone told me. If you're also a man, what does that make me? And it's just like, well, if your gender is so dependent on someone else's expression, like, that's really scary and it sounds really fragile. So I think that it really does indoctrinate us. I think that we're told to man up so much throughout our life. I've never met any man that hasn't been told that they're not man enough. I've never met any woman that hasn't been told she's too emotional or that's unladylike or some sort of standard that is just unreachable. And I think we need to start to unpack that and ask ourselves, what does it actually mean to be a man or a woman? What does that mean for you? And is the way that you express your manhood or your masculinity, is it the same as other men? Because I've never met two men that express their gender in the same way.
So tell me what you learned about male privilege as you transitioned.
Ah, so interesting. I mean, it's interesting because I get male privilege to a certain extent as someone who is cis male passing, which cisgender means, you know, assigned a gender at birth that you identify with for your life. So I get that privilege because I pass as a man, but once people discover I'm transgender, that privilege does kind of dissipate in certain ways. So it is really interesting. I guess, like, as someone who presents as a man as compared to presenting as a woman, I get heaps more space to speak. I'm not talked over as much as I used to be. I'm laughed at. Like, I'm actually funny now. People did not laugh at my jokes beforehand, which was just mean because I think I was always funny. I also get asked to help out a lot more with my strength. Now, when I was presenting as a woman, I was going to the gym all the time and I was super buff, and now I am very weak and fragile and dainty. So I used to get so frustrated when people would be like, all right, we need two men to help us move a table. And I was like, are you serious? I'm stronger than any of the boys here. And now I'm like, I'm not stronger than any of the women here. You know, that is so not the situation. So that's interesting. Also, yeah, I guess I'm privy to the sort of misogynistic language that I wasn't before. Like men who think that I'm not queer or that I'm not trans will just talk about women in a way that I never heard people talk about so directly before, which is, you know, sort of a treat because it means I get to shut them down hard, which I don't always get the opportunity to do because people know me. But it also means that I'm subject to that kind of conversation, which I don't want to be. Also just like walking home alone at night, like I just feel way safer now than I used to. I don't have to look over my shoulder as much. And I actually have to be aware of how the women walking in front of me feel.
Yeah.
Because I realize that they look over their shoulder at me.
How does that feel? Because that's something I'm also aware of. You suddenly aware of a moment walking home and you're just like, oh shit, I'm actually the person someone might be afraid
of. Threat.
I've always found it not a nice realization when it has come to me.
No, it's not nice. I make real efforts. I make a lot of efforts to walk a different way or, you know, quickly sort of speed up and take over by not getting too close. Just doing whatever I can to ensure that people feel really safe. And it also just comes into consent practices as well. Like I just am really on top of enthusiastic consent and making sure people feel safe. And it's just interesting because, like, being in a club, you know, I would go over to a girl who's crying and just be like, oh my god, are you okay, like, do you want to come and like hang out with my friends or something? And before, you know, she would just be like, oh, thank you so much. But now, looking at me thinking I'm a man, she thinks I'm trying to pick her up. So it's just like, it's a really strange shift of perspective, and I just have to constantly be on it of, you know, how am I presenting? What are people reading of me? How do I still show my softness and my sensitivity now that I'm being read as a man?
So I've asked you to do a lot of reflecting here, but I mean, that's fair. This is your memoir. and really, where I want to end is, as you go over this, as you reflect, as you do on society, the places that it does or often fails to find for non-cis, non-white, non-straight people, do you find you're left with hope?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really lucky. I live in Melbourne. I live in a thriving, brilliant queer community. We have so much going on. I am surrounded by some of the most inspirational people I think I will ever meet in my life that are changing the world. Like, I wake up and I go to an event and I am just surrounded by badass queers changing the total social climate. And this is the thing, like, I am just one person in a sea of incredible queers, you know, like, this is not just me, this is a triumph for our community, and so many people are doing such phenomenal things. So I do really have hope. I have a lot of hope. I'm not sure if society on a wider scale will change in the direction exactly that we want it to in my lifetime, but that's not necessarily what I'm working towards. I'm not working towards an idealistic world for me. I'm working towards it for the future and for my kids and my grandkids and queer kids 100 years down the track. Obviously, I would like things to change right now, but whether that's realistic or not is another thing. It's just about, you know, getting out there, educating, doing my very best, trying to be the best person that I can be, and also pulling back and protecting myself when I need to.
The voice you are listening to is Nevo Zizan. We're talking about their book, Finding Nevo. It is a fantastic new memoir. I would encourage people to read it. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for reading the book.
Love for Lease bring Americana Gold to Sydney this July with Joe Pug, direct from Austin, Texas, and new discovery, Courtney Marie Andrews.
And I've come to meet the sheriff.
Joe Pug delivers soul-searching classic songs, and Courtney Marie Andrews' new album, Honest Life, has critics raving. Come experience these two incredible artists at the Lansdowne July 11 and Coogee Diggers July 12. Love Police sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, but not for much longer. My time is almost up for another week. Thank you for joining me as we listen back to a conversation that was originally recorded for Gay Panic, which is on every Friday evening on 2SER. The book is called Finding Nevo, and I was speaking with Nevo Zizan, so big thank you to Nevo. Look, if you want to listen back, if you missed anything, go to 2ser.com. Right now, I'm going to leave you with a track. Stick around for The Vulture's Nest. They will be back in to look at the week in culture and news with their own distinct humour and view. But right now, I've been listening back, getting a bit nostalgic for Australia in the 90s, and this is from Ed Cooper. It's The Way I Made You Feel.
started when I was cleaning dishes and the phone rang in the hall. I was drawn to it against my wishes, ugly memories of the war. I didn't count on mass destruction when I saw you. Was the way the old cafe that existed, the service down the way. And what they were saying for all these years was true, they never were good old days as such. I didn't care.